and welcome to Worlds Apart. From welfare state to warfare state, the EU's attempt to resolve its structural crisis through militarization under the aegis of a potential conflict with Russia may give current politicians some biding time, but what would it mean for the EU as a governing experiment? Will it be able to retain and live out the political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that once used to be its foundational pillars? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Évariste Barthelot, former Maltese Minister for European and Foreign Affairs. Minister, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for this invitation.
Now, I know that you've been involved in politics for the last three decades, first as your country's member of parliament and then as your country's top diplomat. And I want to start by asking if you had any difficulties or contradictions in having to represent Malta both within Europe and to the outside world, especially when it came to the issue of, economic and political sovereignty and decision making.
Well, it's important that we talk a bit about Malta's geography and Malta's history. We are the smallest state in the European Union, and we've had a history of colonization. We're one of the few countries in the European Union which did not have any former empires. In fact, we were, for a very long time, colonized also by one of the former members of the European Union, which is Great Britain. So our historical experience and our perspective is necessarily also shaped by our past. So we cannot, simply go along with those who still find it very difficult to change their colonial mindset. You know, it's easy for flags to be changed, for heads of state to be appointed, for countries to have their national anthem, but colonization runs deep. And I think that one of the problems that the European Union has, that it's still dominated by countries, by leaders who have a colonial mindset. It's as if the empire has not finished. In our case, we have tried, and it's very difficult, to behave like a neutral state, which means that we are constitutionally obliged not to have military bases and not to join any military alliances.
Mm-hmm. Now, Minister, I'm really glad that you brought the Maltese neutrality into the question, because it's enshrined in your constitution. But we live in a very fragmented, let's put it this way, world where your geographic location does make you a very interesting or potentially very important outpost, both for the southern Mediterranean and for Africa. And you've been pretty open in your other interviews that Malta has experienced a lot of American pressure not necessarily being part of NATO, but doing NATO's bidding. And also economically, I think it's important to stress that as an island nation, you may have objectively different economic interests from the rest of continental Europe. So my next question would be, what does it take to balance all these quite divergent sensibilities?
Well, in the last 5 years, there's been a greater push, more than ever before, not that there wasn't before, but basically for the EU to disappear into NATO. In fact, in some of the meetings that we used to have in the Foreign Affairs Council, I used to feel quite uncomfortable, because it was as if the ministerial meeting of the NATO alliance was actually being held in Brussels during the Foreign Affairs Council. And I think that is not good news. It's not good news, I think, not even for the European Union itself, because basically the European Union over the years, and especially I would say in the last 30 to 40 years, gave up the idea of having a different foreign policy, which was in its own strategic interest. And it allowed itself more and more to become simply a vassal of the United States. And I think that was not wise either for the European Union or for the United States itself.
I heard you once compare the EU policy deliberation process to a catwalk in a fashion show, when you're supposed to walk out, strike a pose, perhaps manifest your glorious self, and then walk away without having any discussions whatsoever. What is always like that, or is it a relatively new invention?
Well, what I can tell you is that definitely in the years that I was there as foreign minister, it had deteriorated to that level. Previous foreign ministers told me that the working method used to be much better, that there used to be time for analysis, there used to be time for discussion, and there used to be time for thoughtful decisions. But I can tell you in the years after 2020, the working method had changed, had become very superficial, and you find a lot of people dealing with the rest of the world without knowing, you know, the history, the geography, the reality, and keeping in mind that if you take the G7, if you take the United States, and if you take the European Union, we're basically talking of 14% of the world. But that 14% still believes it's the 100%. And I think such short-sightedness leads to the situation where, for example, I'll just give you an example. You impose sanctions on Russia, and you think that because you are imposing sanctions on Russia, you're going to defeat it, you're going to break it up, because it's as if Russia trades only with you. So you can punish Russia with the trade that you have with Russia. Whereas in fact, there is 86% of the world, and Russia started trading and doing a lot of business with other parts of the world. I think the same mentality runs when it comes to even issues like with China, the same kind of attitude. This very self-absorbed, narcissistic continent, which is on the decline, but still thinks that it's very central in world affairs.
Mm-hmm. Now, you call it strategic short-sightedness, but to me it sounds like, you know, an infantile form of magical thinking when you sort of in a mentality that if you do not look at the things that you don't like, that they somehow will disappear and the world will change to your prescriptions. I mean, it's funny to even express this at this level, but I mean, how do you understand the transition of Europe, which is, you know, a continent with lots of history, with lots of governing and diplomatic and war experience? How do you explain this process of producing that kind of leadership that is, you know, not even short-sighted? It's not looking at things that it's supposed to look by the very duties of the office.
Yes, it's suicidal. I agree with you. It's much more than short-sightedness. It is suicidal. And here it's where Europe is a victim, I think, of its history, because it hasn't reflected on its own history. The world has changed, but the European Union still thinks, and the people within the European Union, especially the leaders of today, still think that the empire goes on. So the colonial mindset of the last 500 years has still not been overcome. Whatever nice words are used, there is still the idea that we know best, we tell you what to do, we are more civilized than you. You know, basically it's the colonial mentality, you know, that I mean, theology, technology, politics, economics, in everything. We are superior in everything. Whereas, in fact, we know that that has never been the case, but especially now. You know, when the former colonies of the former empires are overtaking their former empires technologically, militarily, and economically. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, while we are on this issue of the level of expertise and strategic thinking, I'm very interested in the selection and promotion process within the EU. How does it work? Is it this sort of new generation of leaders who bring with them this antagonistic and short-sighted agenda, or is it the agenda itself that seems to pre-select these kind of individuals who are, you know, ready to do what it requires them to do?
No, to a certain extent, this is the logic of how the United States colonized Western Europe after the Second World War. The United States did all it can to ensure that, okay, the Western Europe would recover, would rebuild its economy, would regain its sovereignty, but as long as this is limited sovereignty, you know, with the kind of block logic, you do what we tell you. If you try to do something different, No, we will not let you. And in fact, to a certain extent, we can, if we want to reflect historically on both blocs, both the Warsaw Treaty and NATO, they were used to discipline the members inside them rather than to confront each other. You know, you do what we tell you. And this is a problem, especially because then from Washington, they start promoting those politicians who know that they will go along with this kind of thinking. You know, number one is the United States. We didn't need President Trump to tell us, you know, let's make America great again or put America first, because it has always been like that since the last at least 80 years. So you promote them, the politicians who are ready to, you know, to be a very obedient Secretary General of NATO and even to call you daddy if there's any.
Now, I heard you say that since 2004, when Malta and other primarily Eastern European states joined the EU, the focus has shifted eastwards and the EU essentially forgot all about its southern flank and the huge African continent that sits across there, the Mediterranean, and sort of shifted its anxious focus eastward. How do you understand that choice of priorities? Because, I mean, at that time, Russia was quite amicable to the West. The relationship was not equal, but I think they were very beneficial for the EU. Russia was sending all the cheap energy sources to Europe. So why was it necessary for Europe to go along with this reorientation of its foreign policy focus?
Well, it's a complex analysis, but I'll try to simplify as much as possible. First of all, I will confirm that the Eastern neighborhood, what is called an Eastern neighborhood, though unfortunately it wasn't considered neighborly but an enemy, which is not the Eastern neighborhood. That's how the policy was called. And Southern neighborhood was not given the same importance. It was very difficult for us in Southern Europe, like Spain, Italy, and Malta, to put Africa and the Mediterranean on the agenda. The push, especially by the Baltic countries and by Eastern European countries, especially Poland, to all the time talk about the Russian threat, even when there is no such threat or when there was no such threat, always meant that on the agenda, you're always discussing relations with Turkey, relations with Russia, relations with China. I remember when I met Minister Lavrov in Sochi, I think it was 4 years ago, he recounted to me when he had met President of the European Commission at that time, Romano Prodi, who had tried to sort of put Lavrov's mind at rest. Listen, now that the Baltic countries and the Eastern European countries are going to join us, as they're going to be part of our club, you know, they will calm down. Minister Lavrov had told him, I think what's going to happen is the other way around. You know, instead of calming the Baltics and the Eastern European countries, the Baltics and the Eastern European countries are going to turn the European Union more into an anti-Russian club. And especially with NATO taking over the European Union, that anti-Russian agenda became even much more pronounced, which is a pity. This year, we should have been celebrating 50 years of the 1975 Helsinki Accord, and then the Charter of Paris, and then the Istanbul Declaration. I don't believe that there was any goodwill on the part of the United States and some of the leaders of the European Union to actually go along with that process, which wanted to create a cooperative security architecture for all the continent.
Well, Minister, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this fascinating conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Hey, I see you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're going to brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Évariste Barthelot, former Maltese Minister for European and Foreign Affairs. Minister, just before the break, we were discussing this issue of contempt, disrespect, perhaps supremacist or racist bias on the part of Western politicians, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But, you know, there was a long process since then. And I want to bring us back to 2004 when Malta joined the European Union. And you mentioned that there was a shift of the EU priorities away from Africa. And, you know, less than a decade later, they came many sort of alarm bells ringing because there were a series of uprisings and wars in the African continent, in North Africa, that sent huge waves of refugees into Europe. So, you know, that brought many of the problems right to the European shores. And at that point of time, I think it was pretty clear that Europe and Russia were on different sides of history, so to say, because they favored clearly very different policies as regards to how you deal with a troubled state. Do you think the war, the conflict between Russia and the West was to some extent inevitable after what happened in Libya and perhaps in Syria?
Yes, of course. Of course, it was inevitable. It was inevitable also because in the case of the European Union, unfortunately, there's no common strategic approach towards Africa. And basically, the former empires have they still try to control their sphere of influence. So the French policy towards Libya, because of that, differs from the Italian policy towards Libya. The same happens with the Sahel. The same happens for other, you know, African countries where there was either French influence or Italian influence. There isn't a common European approach. There isn't a common, not even in one country like Libya, for example. Now, when you see that with all the talk of, you know, of the rule of law, of international relations, of the United Nations, but then when it's convenient for you to go in and, you know, and not seek any mandate from the Security Council and to bring about regime change, you invade a country and then you leave it in a mess. Like, for example, if we see Libya, you know, 14 years later, and Libya is just 40 minutes away from Malta. So for us, it's a very important country. It's in a terrible state still, one of the richest countries in the Mediterranean. And 2/3 of the people are struggling to have enough food to eat, to have enough money to have a decent life and to rebuild their country. It's very easy to go in, bomb a country and then leave. And then what is going to happen? How are you going to rebuild that country? So, and especially how these interventions took place. The United States at that time sometimes tried to seek only the China and Russia to abstain in the Security Council, but then to really, you know, overdo it and really to keep up the domination that you had in the past, even if you change a bit.
It's the domination, I think it's important to stress, it's a domination that brings destruction. It's not just about the will to power on the part of Moscow or Beijing in this case. It's just like, you know, these countries do not want to see other places in the world being ruined for because it gains nothing to anyone, even, you know, the European Union and the United States at this point of time. They are suffering the consequences of their own policies and still refusing to see what has happened. Now, can I ask you something else? Because I heard you say that the Biden administration, for example, has treated Europe with a lot of contempt. The European leaders were not only not consulted, they were not informed about major American decisions. And yet it seems that the European leaders have developed some soft spot for this kind of very subordinate and I would say very disrespectful treatment. How do you explain that? They are not capable of taking any word of, disagreeing word from anyone else, but yet when it comes to the Americans, they're ready to be humiliated and suffer the consequences of totally careless policies.
Well, you know, we've heard of the Stockholm syndrome, no? That I can bully a person, I can really hurt that person, but that person still somehow or other perversely develops an affection towards me to do what I impose on that country to do. There is a Stockholm syndrome between the leaders of the European Union and the United States. I remember, I think we were having an informal council meeting in Slovenia when the United States pulled out of Afghanistan. Most of the ministers there who attend, obviously, the ministerial meetings of NATO were shocked and stunned because not only were they not consulted, they were not even informed. They got to know from the media that the United States had pulled out. So the United States, the State Department, takes for granted the leaders of the European Union. Also because I think they know that they will not develop a strategic, autonomous approach. I remember when we were discussing the document called Strategic Autonomy, where the European Union was supposed to develop its own foreign policy towards the rest of the world and to do it in the interest of the continent and not simply obey what others want. But I remember Juncker at that time saying something which is very wise when he said, to be able to have strategic autonomy, you also need a strategic intellectual mentality. How can you do something autonomously if you don't even think autonomously? And at the moment, a lot of European leaders do not, I don't say don't think autonomously, they don't think, because how they behave is really bad. And what is very worrying, we used to boast, like, for example, there was a big campaign for Malta to join the European Union, mentioning all the time that there is a special European social model where you will have jobs, you will have good jobs, you will have good social services.
The political freedom, economic prosperity, social cohesion.
Exactly, which is different from the American model, which was more neoliberal and where business comes first, second, and third. But now we're moving towards that model. Where is the European social model?
Well,
where is the
European let me ask you specifically about that, because we are running out of time, but it seems that the new solution to hopefully get to that model that you just mentioned is the militarization of the European economies. I mean, many countries are removing legislative blocks on financing military industries, and it seems like they're treating this militarization and the prospect of a future war with Russia as both a safe line and a safe exit out of the EU's many structural crises. What do you think about that? Do you think it's likely to work?
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense militarily, and it doesn't make sense economically and socially. And please let us remember, because the leaders are taking these decisions, it doesn't mean that the citizens are going along. The citizens remember that in 2008, when there was the so-called financial crisis, and I say it so-called because it was, I think, an ethical crisis, where you put, you know, banks and financial...
When you make the rich richer, right, and the poor poorer, absolutely.
So at that moment, countries like Germany and others were saying, don't touch the regulations, deficit should be only 3%, and let us make sure that we are very prudent. Now we're saying, not only 3%, go over the deficit, spend 5% of your budget on armaments and on the military, and at the same time, you have problems with pensioners, you have problem with, health systems, you have problems with infrastructure, you have economic problems where the economy is very weak and growth is very, very slow. And then you think that if instead of producing cars, you produce military tanks or produce military armaments, you're going to solve this problem. It's not going to happen.
Well, Minister, can I ask you something real quick here? Because I think that's an important distinction between the European Union and Russia's approach to that, because Russia has also used the upgrades of its military sector as a driver, as an economic driver. But I think the leadership here tried very hard, despite fighting this three-year war with Ukraine, tried very hard to keep the both the perception and the value of a peaceful life so that people are calm, that they can look forward to the future, that they can invest in the businesses around them. But what we are seeing right now in Europe is, you know, high-level officials calling on people to prepare for a war, to get ready their survival kits, you know, to renovate nuclear bunkers, etc. So there's a clearly an effort to influence the population psychologically, and we here in Moscow find it very, very dangerous. Why do you think the European leaders need their populations to be on edge?
Yes, because when you fail to run your country properly, it is very important to construct an external enemy. You know, it reminds me a bit of that famous poem of Cavafy, you know, waiting for the barbarians. You know, you wake up in the morning and you tell your people, the barbarians are coming. The barbarians will soon be at the gate. By the end of the evening, no barbarians appear. And the question comes, now that the barbarians have not come, what are we going to do? So what is the European Union going to do in 5 years' time, 6 years' time, 7 years' time, when no invasion takes place, and in the meantime, you have dismantled your economic and social system because you say you want to prepare for war? This is an admission of failure from the part of the European leaders to really follow a sensible policy of being faithful to the values which brought about the European Union in the first case, to have soft power, to work for peace, to work for environmental protection, climate change, social justice. Where have all these gone?
Well, Minister, this is all we have time for, but thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
All the best.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.